This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Ghosts, UFOs, cryptids, life after death. You'll hear great thinkers on these subjects and more on the Paranormal Podcast, the longest-running podcast of its type. I'm Jim Harold, and I invite you to join me as we explore the mysteries of life. I bet you love these topics just as much as I do, but don't worry. I won't tell anyone. Join me for some great paranormal conversation. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. Search To Die For in your podcast app to follow the show.
Due to the graphic nature of this killer's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13. Now, enjoy the show. Close your eyes. Think about what you know of the flower power movement of late 1960s. You're probably imagining sit-ins in the park, weed-puffing freely. And you're not entirely wrong. San Francisco became famous for the young people flocking to the city looking for an alternative way to live and love in the shadow of the Vietnam War. The Haight-Ashbury district became so infamous. Bus tours often went through the crowded streets, so tourists could come gawk at the people laying around. But beneath the flower power movement, a man was prowling the back roads of the Bay Area, leaving five bodies in his wake and tormenting local papers with cryptic letters and ciphers.
The Zodiac Killer.
Hi, I'm Greg Polson, and this is Serial Killers, a new podcast diving into the minds and motives of the most infamous criminals around. This is the conclusion to our Zodiac investigation, an anonymous gunman who carved a path through California's Bay Area in the late 1960s. If you want to listen to any previous episodes of Serial Killers, you can find them all on your favorite podcast directory or on our website, parcast.com, spelled parcast.com. A new episode comes out every Monday, and don't forget to subscribe. Here with me is Vanessa Richardson. Vanessa will be answering questions I have about the mental makeup of a serial killer. What makes them tick, what molded them, and what their thought process is like, as well as providing other valuable insight. It's important to note that she's not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but like me, she's fascinated by the psychology of serial killers and has done a lot of research for this show. The Zodiac is officially responsible for 7 attacks in Northern California, killing 5. He started his career with a double murder in Benicia, California, December 1968. 1969 was a very busy year for him. He shot a couple on the 4th of July in 1969, killing one. He bound and stabbed a couple picnicking at Lake Berryessa in September 1969, and finally shot a cab driver in the head in October 1969.
What little we know of the Zodiac can be summed up as such. He was a narcissist bully who knew he was smarter than the police and used it to his advantage. He was brutal, petty, and had a God complex. And, obviously, he was a murderer.
So why do you think he murdered?
Most likely because he felt powerless in his daily life. A killer like the Zodiac thrived on intimidation. His body count is not particularly impressive within the more notorious sphere of killers, but he used threats to keep anxiety high all over San Francisco. The anxiety he caused through threats would have given him a feeling of power, fulfilling some of the psychological need he was meeting by killing.
So in a way, he victimized a lot more than just those he killed and their families.
Well, I wouldn't want to disrespect the victims and the loss their families suffered, but he absolutely had a negative impact on the people of San Francisco. He terrorized the city, and that's part of why he's still showing up in pop culture today. On top of being terrifying, he was a mystery. People just love a good mystery.
Even if it puts them in fear for their lives.
Yes, that's part of why so many people have tried to crack the ciphers.
So by solving the ciphers, they could solve at least part of the mystery of the Zodiac and make him a little less terrifying?
Yes.
Quick refresher on the ciphers. In between all the murdering, the Zodiac killer took the time to write several Bay Area newspapers, sending mocking letters and ciphers that he tasked the public with decoding. The letters would ebb and flow, but spiking when the news shifted off the hunt for the Zodiac. But they didn't officially cease until 1974. Soon, scores of people put their brains to work trying to solve his riddles.
It's like you need a damn Turing machine.
What if it's numeric?
He replaces every other letter.
No, it can't be. There are breaks in the pattern.
Oh, what if he misspelled some words?
No one who can make this is going to misspell something. Don't be ridiculous.
The Zodiac had firmly taken root in the public's consciousness, and he dominated the media for years. And he's endured. In fact, one of his most famous ciphers thought to be unbeatable was only just cracked in 2012. And he soon became the butt of political jokes. Just last year, one of the leading nominees for the Republican presidential ticket was jokingly accused of being the Zodiac. That joke spread like wildfire.
And it's still going. Quote, Ted Cruz is the Zodiac killer, turns up over 70,000 Google hits, including everything from YouTube, quote, video proof, and Facebook memes, to articles in The Guardian and The New York Times. With the Zodiac killer seemingly gone for good, people love the absurdity of pinning his crimes on Ted Cruz.
Come on. Ted Cruz is clearly innocent. He wasn't even born till 1970.
It's all good fun, but it points to the bigger problem, that the Zodiac killer is still haunting the American public, especially when there's been no evidence of the Zodiac inspiring a copycat.
Right. So how has his bizarre legacy endured?
Well, according to former FBI profiler John Douglas, many serial killers are motivated by a desire to create and sustain their own mythology. The letters, the phone calls, the symbol, they all fit into a mythos. Other killers like the BTK and Theodore Kaczynski fit this profile, though each of them was eventually caught by what they sent the police. The Zodiac wasn't.
So as such, his letters have cemented the Zodiac in the lore of American mysteries, and the intriguing frustration of a murderer who will never be brought to justice keeps our interest piqued. Paul Stein, the cab driver, was the Zodiac's last confirmed kill. Shot in the head in the Presidio District of San Francisco in October 1969. But a dark, empty highway would become a nightmare for a young mother when the killer decided to take a late-night drive in 1970. A very pregnant Kathleen Johns was driving on the empty streets of Modesto, California with her young daughter when a car started following her and flashing its lights. He offered to fix her allegedly loose tire, but as soon as she drove away, it came off completely. She nearly spun out before she was able to brake. And wouldn't you know it, the same car pulled right back up. Kathleen bundled up her daughter and accepted his ride to the service station. They drove aimlessly for 90 minutes. Kathleen's accounts of what happened next vary, but in every version, the man threatened to kill her and her daughter. Kathleen rolled out of the car when he slowed to a stop, sprinting away into a field with her daughter. She hid while the man searched with a flashlight. She hid in the field until the man got frustrated and went back to his car.
She was incredibly lucky the killer gave up looking.
Lucky? After being threatened by a notorious killer?
I'm not comparing her to a lottery winner. Poor Kathleen Johns clearly went through a horrifying ordeal, but she escaped before being shot or stabbed. That's better off than anyone else who interacted with the Zodiac. He let her go. Had he kept looking and found her, well, we'd be looking at a different case.
So do serial killers often let their intended victims go?
No. Serial killers often have people in their life they keep around that are not connected to their crimes, such as Ted Bundy's sweetheart turned wife, but it isn't common for a killer to simply let someone escape. Had Kathleen been taken to a second location, it isn't probable she would have survived.
Point taken. Continuing her so-called luck, Kathleen managed to flag down another passing motorist who drove her to a police station. Another squadron of police drove back to Modesto to search for Kathleen's car. Her car was a burned-out husk on the side of the road. It had been gutted and torched. An expensive loss for a young mother, but she had escaped with her life. No one knows for sure why Kathleen was targeted. After all, she was a single woman, again diverging from the Zodiac's early pattern of couples. So now, Vanessa, is it possible the Zodiac targeted Kathleen, a lone woman, after killing Paul Stein, a lone man, as the other half of sort of a sick couple?
You're suggesting that since all his other kills were double homicides, the Zodiac felt like he had unfinished business after a single homicide?
Yes.
Well, the compulsion to only kill in pairs and the way the Zodiac cleaned up after the cab murder could be symptoms of OCD.
Because he killed in pairs, do you think there was an obsession with numbers?
Maybe. According to the Yale Child Study Center, some of the symptoms of OCD include symmetry, which more broadly includes repeating, ordering, and counting compulsions, forbidden thoughts, which include aggression, and compulsive cleaning. To boil it down to very basic terms, OCD is a psychological disorder driven by a need for things to feel right, by following rules specific to the person suffering from it.
Well, that could be the Zodiac.
Yeah, well, serial killers in general suffer from a myriad of psychological disorders. And without knowing the full range of symptoms, even a clinical psychiatrist would be as confident in diagnosing the Zodiac with OCD as you are of diagnosing your stomachache using WebMD.
Okay, I see your point.
It's more likely that in both cases, the Zodiac was itching to kill, but hadn't come across a vulnerable couple in a while, so he took his opportunity.
Okay, back to Kathleen Johns. Her escape would lead to as lucky a break as could be in the case.
Did you see the make and model of the car?
It was dark. I couldn't really tell.
What about him?
A round face. Glasses. He was tubby, maybe? He was... Oh my God.
The police sketch for Paul Stein's murderer was hanging on the wall, and Kathleen recognized it instantly. With this, the police had a link.
Not the biggest clue, but I suppose that gave them some insight on the killer they wouldn't have had otherwise.
Actually, most of what we know about the Zodiac was what he told the police and newspapers himself. Let's go back to an earlier attack. September 1969. A beautiful fall day would become the scene for the Zodiac's most brutal murder. College students Cecilia Shepherd and Brian Hartnell were picnicking at Napa, California's Lake Berryessa, about 50 miles north of the crime scenes in Vallejo, when they were approached by a man with a gun and rifle crosshairs spray-painted onto his black smock.
Give me all your money.
Take it, please. It's all yours.
He told them he was an escaped convict from Montana. And Brian would later go on to say that at first, he believed they were simply being robbed. He instructed Cecilia to bind Brian in clothesline that he had brought with him. He tightened the knots she had loosely fastened, trapping Brian. The Zodiac stabbed Brian and Cecilia repeatedly before leaving them beside the lake, still tied and bound. Brian managed to survive the trauma. Cecilia did not. But before she passed, she was able to give a description of the man who attacked them. Her description was identical to the man who killed Paul Stein in the cab just 2 weeks after the Lake Berryessa stabbings. The same man who Kathleen Johns claimed picked her and her daughter up on that quiet stretch of road in Modesto, California. The Zodiac certainly thought they were both done for because he called the Napa police from a payphone to report a double murder.
Phone calls, letters, it's as if he wanted to be caught. This actually tracks back to his narcissism, like the letters, and to his profile as a thrill killer. He was putting himself in an even more dangerous situation, seeking a bigger sensation by reporting his own crimes.
Is the thrill of being caught addictive like other forms of adrenaline?
More likely, it was the thrill of knowing he got away with murder so close to a police station. He bragged after the Paul Stein murder that he had walked by the police not 3 blocks from the scene. Someone who believes they're smart enough to get away with murder would want to rub it in.
So that's what he meant by, quote, "it's better than getting your rocks off," unquote?
Yes.
Here's how that call went.
Napa Valley Sheriff's Office, how may I direct your call?
If your officers drive to Twin Oak Ridge at Lake Berryessa, you will find 2 college students tied up. I stabbed them both.
Sir? You stabbed them?
You'd better hurry. They were bleeding a lot.
When Napa police found Brian's car, the killer had scrawled his signature Zodiac symbol, along with, quote, "Vallejo, December 20th, 68, July 4th, 69, September 27th, 69, 6:30, by knife," unquote. In a sick way, the car door helped solidify the timeline for police. It gave them a concrete map of his whereabouts and a running list of his victims up to that point. 2 on Lake Herman Road, 1 Vallejo, and 1 in Lake Berryessa. Paul Stein would bring the Zodiac's body count up to 5 just 1 month later.
So we can link the crimes, but still no killer.
We'll return to our story in just a moment.
And now back to serial killers.
Looking back at the Zodiac's attacks, you'd be tempted to call him insane, wouldn't you? Crazy, unhinged, dangerous?
In actuality, it would be a mistake to characterize a psychopath as simply crazy. Psychopath is often interchanged with psychotic, but this isn't technically accurate. Dr. Robert Hare defined psychotic, and I quote, "Psychotic refers to a break with reality, that kind of hallucinations and delusions that, say, a patient with schizophrenia might have. Psychotic patients can sometimes act bizarre, and they can be violent, but generally someone who's psychotic isn't aware of the consequences of their actions. Psychopaths, on the other hand, know exactly that they're up to no good. They just don't seem to care." End quote. A lack of concern for consequences is a hallmark of both psychopathy and sociopathy, but psychopathy tends to be malicious in its indifference.
Dr. Robert Hare described a psychopath's mindset as, quote, "people who, I think at their core, lack a real concern or emotional connection with other people. They don't seem to understand that other people have rights. I think this is partly because of a stunning incapacity, a lack of capacity for empathy."
A lack of empathy is another combining thread for sociopathy and psychopathy, but a moral compass is what ultimately separates them. A psychopath, by a trait of birth, does not possess one. A sociopath does have what we call a conscience, but it's a skewed one.
Hare continued, quote, "Of course, associated with that are all sorts of other things. We have individuals whose emotional life is fairly shallow, fairly superficial. These are people who use deceit and manipulation to intimidate and control other individuals. Tend to be very dominant and controlling people," unquote.
Dr. Hare said a few other hallmarks were an enormous sense of entitlement, being impulsive, but in a controlled sense, and perhaps leading an enigmatic lifestyle.
There certainly were enigmas in the case. On October 22, 1969, the Oakland, California Police Department received a phone call from a man claiming to be the infamous Zodiac Killer, who had killed a cab driver in San Francisco just 11 days earlier. The man demanded he be allowed to speak to local lawyer Melvin Belli. He called into a television studio and spoke to Belli and host Jim Dunbar live on the air. He called himself Sam. In actuality, it was a patient at the local mental hospital, but for a few hours, San Francisco believed they were hearing from their own personal boogeyman. This is so bizarre to me. Why would someone claim to be a serial killer?
It's bizarre, but it's not uncommon. According to the Innocence Project, approximately 1 out of every 4 confessions made by convicts are false. There's a lot to be said about police pressure and possibly unethical interrogation techniques, but still, 25% of people confessed to crimes didn't commit them. Now, some false confessions are misguided ploys for attention and fame. Over 200 people confessed to the Lindbergh kidnapping because it was a famous case. Sadly, as in the case of Sam, Some false confessions are signs of psychosis, where someone actually believes they are the person they hear about on the news.
Or Jesus Christ or Anastasia Romanoff?
Mm-hmm. It's more tragic than anything. On TV, poor Sam just claimed he didn't want to be hurt. But with this information, we have to consider something else.
And what would that be?
Oh, that the letters were a hoax.
You mean to say that the most famous aspect of the Zodiac Killer was just a ploy for attention or a sick prank?
I'm not saying they were a hoax. After all, the letter including Paul Stein's bloody shirt had to be real, no doubt there. But the others, we can't know for sure. We also can't know that Paul Stein's killer didn't just take credit for the earlier murders. However, due to the relative scarcity of murderers, they were probably all the same guy. Now, I don't think the letters were sent by anyone but the Zodiac Killer, but some people think the letters were an example of the false confession phenomenon. A man named Thomas Horan has written 3 entire books on the subject, if any of you are interested. But for analysis purposes, let's look at the letters under the assumption that he did write them. After all, most people don't even question the letter's authenticity due to the fact that, at the very least, the letter to the Chronicle with Paul Stein's shirt was very, very authentic.
Looking at the letters, we can't ignore the ciphers, his most famous calling card. Many of the letters and ciphers were misspelled, even simple words such as forest and paradise mangled. It seems paradoxical that a man who could produce such comprehensive, often complex puzzles could also eschew a dictionary.
That's an E.
No, the square was the E.
This has to be 2. There's no other way it could fit.
So, he's using 2 symbols.
At least. Most likely more.
They were correct. The Zodiac used multiple symbols for the same letters in his codes, in an attempt to throw off codebreakers. He used 12 symbols for E alone. It didn't work.
I think we have it.
Are you sure?
I like killing people because it is so much fun. It is more fun than killing wild game in the forest because man is the most dangerous animal of all.
A schoolteacher from Salinas, Donald Hardin, and his wife Betty cracked the Zodiac's famous most dangerous game cipher over the course of 3 days in 1969. And like a true school teacher, he noticed the killer's substandard spelling. So then, how did they crack the code?
Well, Donald and Betty began looking for duplicating symbols, which would suggest a double letter. Once they decided on kill, they looked for other 4-letter words with repeating patterns. And so a code was cracked. A code which professional Navy codebreakers couldn't even get a handle on. The Zodiac's misspellings became more egregious the longer the letters went on, but analysts have suggested the errors may not have been carelessness, but intentional. Handwriting expert William Baker believed the Zodiac was putting on a character.
I would judge that he has a post-high school education, although it could be self-education. He's probably trying to steer people off.
He believed the misspellings were too deliberate to be genuine, and the childish, sloppy handwriting also seemed disingenuous.
The writing is not natural. It is very contrived.
So why would the Zodiac purposefully make himself seem less intelligent than he probably was? I mean, what would he have to gain from being ridiculed in the paper?
Well, I'll tell you. In research conducted by Dr. Robert Hanlon at Northwestern University, he studied 77 incarcerated killers. Intellectually, he was able to determine that he believed impulse killers were less intelligent than meticulous planners.
So why disguise yourself as someone with a lower intelligence?
A narcissist would realistically never put themselves in a bad light, as it goes against their very instinct. But a man toying with the police would do anything to keep the game fresh.
In that case, what are the odds he actually had above average intelligence?
Well, the letters were comically misspelled, but in such a heavy-handed way that they looked like a character. The Zodiac had to have some experience crafting codes, as even Navy codebreakers had difficulty with them. He was not a stupid man, despite how badly he wanted everyone to think he was.
Right. The Zodiac was at least intelligent enough to know to cover his tracks. A partial handprint was found on the payphone the killer used to report the Lake Berryessa attack, but it yielded no DNA matches. Saliva was found in some of the envelopes sent to the newspapers, but that was a dead end as well. DNA evidence also exonerated the heir apparent suspect to the crime, Arthur Lee Allen. Robert Graysmith's novel, Zodiac, perpetuates the Arthur Lee Allen accusation, and on paper, Allen seems the most obvious choice. An odd loner who was fired from his job at a school for molesting a student. He's the textbook bad guy. His friend Don Chaney approached the SFPD with his suspicions, and his evidence was damning.
He said he was writing a book, some kind of story he just made up, but the ideas he had? No normal person has those ideas.
Tell me.
His main character, he said he would use a pen light on a gun, blind the people before he shot them. He said he would loosen their tires and pick them off when they couldn't drive away. And he likes to draw that symbol.
The crosshairs?
Yeah. Like I said, it's weird. It don't sit well. But he's always reading that weird stuff. A bunch of people hunting each other on an island.
Hunting each other?
Are you thinking about The Most Dangerous Game?
Yes! He loves that one.
Our story will continue in a moment, after a brief message.
And now, back to the story.
Next is a quote from his first cipher, the ones the Hardens cracked.
It is more fun than killing wild game in the forest, because man is the most dangerous animal of all.
Though completely circumstantial, Allen wore a Zodiac brand wristwatch, and he lived on the same block in Vallejo as Darlene Farron, his third victim. The 4th of July murder in Vallejo was only 4 minutes away from Allen's house. Michael Majot, who survived the attack that claimed Darlene, echoed Robert Graysmith's suspicions. In 1992, Majot was shown another police lineup. He immediately zeroed in on Arthur Lee Allen. But no evidence was conclusive, and in fact, openly contradicted Graysmith's and Majot's claims. Allen died of natural causes in August 1992, and in 2002, his DNA was once again tested against the Zodiac letters containing saliva. Once again, no match was found. And no other suspects separated themselves from the herd. Whoever the Zodiac was, he managed to control his murderous urges for decades. Would this suggest his urges were not pathological?
We don't know. Pathological is the clinical way to say compulsive or obsessive, which, as we discussed earlier, no one can properly diagnose without having met the Zodiac. Someone who kills pathologically does so because they cannot help themselves. They know their actions are wrong, but the desire overwhelms their guilt. It's like an itch they can't help but scratch.
Is it possible for a killer to find peace, well, lack of a better word, after a certain amount of carnage?
If it's a true compulsion, not without a lot of professional help. In situations such as the Zodiac, he was either incapacitated or transferred his obsession to a new target.
Is it possible for a killer to simply grow bored of his plan?
Compulsion is not often overcome by internal forces. External forces, such as therapy or capture, are the most likely ways to stop a compulsive criminal.
The Zodiac case is still technically open in Napa Valley, Vallejo, and San Francisco, though no new evidence or suspects have come forward. As suddenly and shockingly as the spree started, it just ended. The city moved on, and people were no longer afraid to send their children to school on buses. The Chronicle and the Examiner no longer waited for mysterious packages with no return address to make their way to their mailroom. And then a fresh killer, known as the Night Stalker, took the mantle of California's most feared killer in the 1980s. The last confirmed letter from the Zodiac was sent to the Chronicle on May 8, 1974. It became known as the Badlands Letter.
Sirs, I would like to express my consternation concerning your poor taste and lack of sympathy for the public, as evidenced by your running of the ads for the movie Badlands. Featuring the blurb, in 1959, most people were killing time. Kit and Holly were killing people. In light of recent events, this kind of murder glorification can only be deplorable at best.
He signed it, a citizen. Though a few letters trickled in over the next 4 years, the SFPD felt they were simply copycats looking to cash in on the Zodiac's waning glory. The Zodiac held the Bay's attention for 6 languishing years, and then signed off as simply another citizen. Vanessa, what could justify the sudden about-face regarding the Zodiac's desire for notoriety?
The popular suspect, Arthur Lee Allen, was jailed during the Zodiac's notable absences. The killer was either apprehended for unrelated crimes, incapacitated, or faking a compulsion.
If it was truly attention he wanted, attention he got. He spawned a best-selling novel which was adapted into an equally stylish David Fincher movie. And yet most of what we know of him is conjecture, hypothesis, or gossip. We as people are hardwired to look for patterns, and often hope for black and white endings. Good perseveres, the evil are punished, and with the killer behind bars, something so horrific could not happen again.
As someday it may happen that a victim must be found. I've got a little list. I've got a little list of society offenders who might well be underground, who would never be missed.
But there is no such ending for the Zodiac. Despite the best minds in the SFPD dogging him for years, despite the little slips in DNA evidence, despite the facial analysis, eyewitnesses, and general daredevil carelessness of the killer, no one was able to bring him to justice. In all probability, he was able to live a normal life despite the violence he inflicted on 7 people.
I am rather unhappy because you people will not wear some nice Zodiac buttons. So I now have a little list, starting with the woman and her baby, that I gave a rather interesting ride for a couple hours one evening a few months back, that ended in my burning her car where I found them.
His victims were random and unassuming. Nothing connected them beyond incredibly bad luck. He could have struck anyone at any time for no discernible motive beyond anger at the world. He most likely was, in the textbook sense of the word, a psychopath. Smart enough to know that what he was doing was wrong, but deranged enough to do it anyway. And smart enough to keep his face and fingerprints to himself.
Like I've always said, I am crackproof. If the blue meanies are ever going to catch me, they had better get off their fat asses and do something. Because the longer they fiddle and fart around, the more slaves I will collect for my afterlife. SFPD 0, Zodiac 17 plus.
The case is still open in much of the Bay Area, and who knows? One man was able to evade detection for decades. Who's to say it won't happen again? Thank you for listening to Serial Killers. Be sure to join us next Monday as we start our look into the mind of Alexander Pichushkin. If you enjoyed this episode, please tell your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Serial Killers on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or any other podcast directory. Or through our website, parcast.com. That's parcast.com. A new episode of Serial Killers comes out every Monday. Let us know what you think and join the conversation on our Parcast Facebook page. You can tweet us at Parcast Network. That's Parcast Network. Have a killer week. Serial Killers was created by Max Cutler and developed by Ron Cutler. It's a production of Cutler Media and it's part of the Parcast Network. It's produced by Max and Ron Cutler, and sound design is by Ron Shapiro with production assistance by Joel Stein and Maggie Admire. Serial Killers is written by Samantha Gourash and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson. The amazing cast of voice actors includes, by alphabetical order, Jerry Courtney Osteen, Mike Capozzi, Nicholas Massu, Manu Narayan, and Steve Pinto.